From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Many states are starting to crack down on people who text while they drive. Utah has taken the lead on that issue. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine explains why.
The afternoon of February 20th, lawmakers in a committee room on Utah's Capitol Hill were paying little attention to the business at hand. The reintroduction of legislation to ban text messaging while driving. But then Reggie Shaw came to the mic, and suddenly the room was quiet.
The lady that just spoke mentioned of an accident caused in September 2006. I was the one driving the car, texting while driving.
Two men were killed in that accident, both scientists and fathers. The 19-year-old Shaw served 30 days in jail and was ordered to perform 100 hours of community service. He was the last person in Utah to receive such a light sentence. Shaw's testimony last February galvanized Utah lawmakers to pass the toughest law in the nation on texting while driving.
If you are just caught for texting while driving, it can be up to 3 months in jail and a $750 fine.
Brent Wilhite is program director for Zero Fatalities, the state's public campaign against distracted driving.
If you kill someone, it's up to 15 years in prison and a $10,000 fine.
17 other states have laws on texting and driving, some with penalties as light as a $20 fine. But calls for strong action in other states are becoming louder. A national poll this year showed a quarter of all drivers with cell phones admit to texting. Utah is releasing this week to high schools a 15-minute video spotlighting the Reggie Shaw case. The video, which shows photos of mangled cars from the wreckage, has had more than 500,000 downloads in just over a month.
Is he breathing? I would say he's not breathing.
Leila Odell is the wife of one of the men killed by teen driver Reggie Shaw. In this excerpt, she talks about when she learned 5 months after her husband was killed that Shaw had been texting.
And I remembered being so shocked that someone could be so selfish and irresponsible and kill my husband.
University of Utah psychologist David Strayer tracks eye movements while people text and try to drive. He says people really do take their eyes off the road, often for the same amount of time it takes to drive the length of a football field. Imagine doing that blind. And it's the cognitive distraction that also makes it dangerous.
In terms of accident risk, you're more likely to be hit from someone who's text messaging than someone who's drunk. And that's a pretty alarming statistic.
In fact, his research shows that texting results in an impairment level double that of drunk driving. In the university's simulated driving laboratory, research assistant Sarah Bell sits in what looks like a giant video game. On a screen in front of her, animated cars and trucks whiz by in the lane next to her. As she texts and drives, the car in front randomly brakes.
What just happened there?
It's gonna give me a heart attack. I was looking at my phone and I didn't see the car brake. And it almost killed both of us.
After years of research, Dr. Strayer is heartened now to see that the issue is being taken seriously.
When it becomes stigmatized and you have the legislation and the education and science all together as a package, you'll change people's behavior. And until you have that package in place, you're not going to see systematic changes in driver behavior.
Federal legislation is pending to pressure states into prohibiting drivers from texting while driving, or risk losing a quarter of their yearly federal highway funding. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
Yesterday, we heard about Utah's tough law prohibiting texting while driving. Other states have similar laws, and federal legislation is pending to cover all states. But just like driving drunk, people still text behind the wheel. So high-tech companies are racing to develop devices to make it harder to do. One company in Utah has a new device aimed specifically at teen drivers. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine has the story.
Brandy Terry was 17 years old in her junior year of high school. She was driving one day on her way to visit her grandpa in northern Utah.
I woke up to a bright light. It was like I could barely open my eyes, and paramedics, this man was just saying, "Brandy, Brandy," you know. I just started crying. I didn't know what happened.
She had run through a red light. Police checked her phone and discovered she'd sent a text within seconds of the accident. Terry shattered her right ankle and broke her upper right arm in half. She couldn't walk for 6 months and had an agonizing recovery. She got better, got another car, and tried to stop texting.
I tried really, really hard not to. And then it got to the point where I would do it only, you know, once every 5 minutes. You know, I would rarely do it. And then it got to the point when I was alone in the car, I would do it. I don't know. It's just so addicting. I just can't put it down.
A nationwide survey this year showed an estimated 45% of drivers, 30 or younger, are sending or receiving texts behind the wheel. Teens call it driving while intoxicated. Within a year of her first accident, Brandy Terry did it again. She slammed into the back of a semi while she was texting. This time, she escaped injury.
We all wish it was as simple as you know, just don't do it.
Mike Fonert is president of Safe Driving Systems in South Jordan, Utah. Because it's not that simple, his company has come up with a device to disable the phones of texting drivers.
This technology just helps keep you from doing it.
The company's Eric Bowden demonstrates how it works. He starts off with something called a K2SD, or a key to safe driving device.
Well, we're in my car, and we'll plug the key into the port on the car.
The key is actually a small rectangular plug that's inserted into the onboard diagnostic port that's underneath the dashboard of most cars.
We start the car. It takes 30 seconds to pull and determine if, you know, if there's a signal out there.
Once the car is on, a wireless signal is sent to the driver's cell phone.
That beep is just an audio indicator that it's entered safe driving mode.
The words safe driving mode pop up on his cell phone screen. The phone is now disabled for all incoming and outgoing calls and texts, except for emergency calls. This product is all part of an emerging industry that's creating technology to minimize or eliminate driving distraction. There's San Diego-based DriveCam that equips cars with video cameras to capture risky driving. Still, other products on the market rely on GPS technology that detect when a car is moving and turn off the cell phone. But because these products are motion-based, they can end up blocking cell use even when the caller's sitting in the back of a cab or on a bus. But the bottom line is, are Americans, especially teens, ready to give up driving distractions? Not these teens.
Heck no. I would break it right then.
Heck no. We would not even go near that. We don't need that.
It's 2 o'clock, school's out, and Pri Tautelli and Brittany Louie and friends are piling into a Mini Cooper in Salt Lake City. They didn't like the thought that their parents would have a device in their car to block calls and texts.
I love texting and driving. It's the in thing.
It's fun.
I mean, everyone does it. Like, who doesn't, you know?
Teens, frankly, can sometimes be devious. So the Safe Driving Systems device allows parents to set up a password-protected profile. If the key is unplugged from the car, a tattletale function sends off a text message alerting the parent. Teens in this high school parking lot may not be rushing to sign up. But remember Brandy Terry, now 19, the teen who's had 2 major accidents because she can't stop texting, says she'll be the first in line when the product goes to market later this fall. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brendine in Salt Lake City.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
President Obama said this past week that the U.S. will not deploy a planned ground-based missile defense system in Eastern Europe. Instead, a different system will be put in place. There's been plenty of diplomatic and political fallout over this decision, but not a lot of talk about whether the new approach would actually work. NPR's J.J. Sutherland decided to find out why.
With enough jargon to bring joy to a geek's heart, General James Cartwright outlined the vision for missile defense in Europe.
As we move then to the second phase, which, as the Secretary said, is somewhere around the 2015 timeframe, we expect to have an upgrade to the SM-3 Block 1A, which will be called the SM-3 Block 1B. We're a little bit anal about this, but that's the way we laid it out.
Here's what he's actually saying. The missile that shoots down missiles, called the Standard Missile 3, will be upgraded over time. It will be deployed on ships and eventually on land in and around Europe. The goal is to defend the continent from short and medium-range Iranian ballistic missiles. The Obama administration says the new system is just better than the one they're scrapping. Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
We now have proven capabilities to intercept these ballistic missiles with land and sea-based interceptors, supported by much improved sensors.
How proven are those capabilities? Theodore Postol is a professor at MIT, former advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, and something of a missile defense skeptic. He says some successful tests, and the shooting down of a satellite last year, give him some confidence in the system.
There are problematic features of the defense, but that's true of all defenses. But if you're just talking about the sort of the general engineering assessment of the two systems, I think it is clear that the Navy system is far better tested.
The Navy system is the new one. To understand what's still problematic, you need to know a little bit about how these missiles work.
Think of a missile in space as the equivalent of a light bulb in a totally dark environment.
The interceptor can easily see that light, but it can't really see any details of the target from any distance, and it's moving incredibly fast towards it.
Which means you only have a tenth of a second or a fraction of a second to make any adjustments, which is essentially no time. So one of the problems you would have with a system like this is you tend to hit the middle of the target.
Which you would think would be a good thing, but it isn't. The middle is not the warhead. It's the rocket. So the rocket might be destroyed, but the warhead keeps going. It's like a ball that's already been thrown. Postol says for the current threat, conventionally armed missiles, that's not ideal, but there's only so much damage they can do. But then there's the nightmare scenario.
If the threat becomes nuclear, it's quite serious, and in my view, the defense will not be adequate. Not because this is a bad choice, but it's because the nature of the problems these kinds of defenses fundamentally face.
And that, says Postol, is what the debate should be about.
People talking about, for example, us giving up our defensive capability. Well, if you don't have much defensive capability, I don't know what you're giving up.
J.J. Sutherland, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And today we're talking about batteries. Not just any batteries, car batteries. The next generation of hybrid and electric vehicles will have a lighter, more powerful kind of battery inside, a lithium-ion battery. Automakers around the world are investing billions in development in a race to build an electric car that is both efficient and affordable. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton toured a lab in Detroit to get a peek at just how hard it is to make one of these batteries.
There's three things you'll notice right away about electric cars. First, they're really quiet. Second, they accelerate instantly because electricity is immediately available to the wheels. And third, they'll be expensive. Some of the billions that car makers are investing in battery technologies will show up in the sticker price.
This is our new, what we call battery systems test lab.
Ron Jameson is in charge of General Motors' new 33,000 square foot battery lab. GM has invested $1 billion in its Chevy Volt program to build a car that can go 40 miles on battery power alone. The lab is filled with computers and black or silver chambers that look like huge meat lockers.
Most of them are just temperature only, and then these big silver ones that you see here, both are temperature and humidity.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the lithium-ion batteries inside the chambers charge and discharge under different conditions of climate and load. The tests will ensure the batteries are not only reliable, but will last 10 years or more. The lab also runs continuous tests on individual cells. There are more than 200 lithium-ion cells in one 400-pound battery. Each cell has to be perfect, or the battery won't work. GM's Brian Corbett trots one over.
This is a cell for the, I guess it's about the size of a greeting card.
The cell is a flat pouch. It's something like an 8x5 padded mailing envelope, except it looks like it was made out of saran wrap. A lot of energy is stored in this little package, but Ron Jameson says the cells won't catch fire even if the battery pack is crushed in an accident.
It's almost like the test results are boring because, you know, you might expect, well, wow, if I dunk this in water or short it out or whatever, I would expect some very bad results, and it has been very, very benign. I like to say boring.
GM says the Chevy Volt will be available by the end of next year. Other car makers will launch electric and hybrid cars with lithium-ion batteries in 2011 and 2012. Car companies say over time the cost will go down as more drivers fuel their cars at the electric outlet instead of the gas pump. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
The lagoon surrounding the 1,300-year-old island city of Venice is the site of an ambitious engineering project. It involves the construction of mobile floodgates aimed at safeguarding one of the world's most endangered cities. But some scientists say the project may not be enough to protect Venice from rising sea levels caused by climate change. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli has this report.
Venice rose from mudflats in the middle of a lagoon which forms the largest wetland in the Mediterranean. The island city has been subject to increasing flooding due to sinking land but also to rising sea levels. It's known as Acqua Alta, high water, which brings city life to a standstill for several hours. Big boats can't go under low-hanging bridges and water seeps into buildings through the sewage system. Venetians have not lived on the ground floor for decades. Sophisticated technology is now being used for what has become a full-scale emergency. At one of the three inlets that lead from the sea into the lagoon, a massive mechanical hammer is driving a steel and concrete piling into the lagoon bed. Elena Zambardi works for the consortium Safeguarding Venice. She says the use of pilings was invented by the visionaries who founded the city 1,300 years ago.
In Venice, for example, under the Salute Church and the Rialto Bridge, there are piles, wooden piles, to consolidate the subsoil.
The project acronym is MOSE, which is also the Italian word for Moses, recalling the biblical parting of the sea. Once completed in 2014, there will be 78 large mobile floodgates at the three inlets. When not in use, they'll lay below water on the lagoon bed. When a high tide is forecast, Zambardi says, the gates will rise and shut off the sea from the lagoon.
And Moses will defend Venice if the sea level rises up to 60 centimeters.
But the project, which is 54% completed, has been hounded by controversy, and critics say may already be outdated. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has forecast a sea level rise by the end of this century of between 18 and 59 centimeters. But scientists caution it could be even higher. Marine scientist Laura Carbonin has been studying the Venetian lagoon for decades. Like many scientists, she fears rising sea levels could mean the floodgates will be closed often and for long periods. That would upset the vital exchange between the sea and the lagoon, suffocating its delicate ecosystem. Carbonin co-authored a report that suggests another radical solution.
To complement the MOSE solution, it is necessary that all the city is uplifted.
She says research already suggests the feasibility of raising Venice.
Based on hydrogeological and geochemical data, the preliminary simulation show that fluid injection into deep formation can uniformly raise Venice up to 30 centimeters over 10 years.
Carbonin hypothesizes injections of salt water or even carbon dioxide at a depth of 600 to 800 meters below the lagoon. But she concedes much more research is needed. That would mean huge investments at a time when delays in state funding for the $6 billion plus MOSES have already substantially delayed the project's completion. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News.
You've heard of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. How about a tooth for an eye? That's the trade that a Mississippi woman made to regain her eyesight. From member station WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone has the story of a strange medical procedure which doctors say has never been done in the U.S. before.
60-year-old Kay Thornton sits at a table in front of a growing audience in an auditorium at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. It's been a long journey for the Mississippi native, who's been blind for the past 9 years.
If y'all could take a week out and just keep your eyes closed for a week, walk around your house and just pretend you're blind for 1 week. It's amazing when you open your eyes back up.
Kay was blind through the births of 7 grandchildren. Her blindness is from Stevens-Johnson syndrome, a rare life-threatening condition that causes outer layers of skin to separate from inner. In Kay's case, it left her corneas terribly scarred. She was blind and told nothing could be done. So Kay's daughter began researching top hospitals and booked an appointment at Bascom-Palmer in Miami, 1,000 miles from her home in Smithdale, Mississippi.
She just said, "Mama, I'll have you an appointment." So Rick and I loaded the truck up and we came down to Miami.
Kay spent 2 years doing failed grafts and transplants in Miami when a cornea transplant expert began his own work at Bascom-Palmer. Dr. Victor Perez was frustrated with cases of patients like Kay who were blinded by severe cornea damage. The rest of their eye was fine, but simply put, the lens of their camera was too dirty. He was lobbying to try out a foreign technique when, unprompted, a fellow doctor sent Kay through Dr. Perez's door.
And Kay walked through my clinic. I saw her and I told her, "I know exactly what we're going to do with you."
What he planned to do was something dreamed up by Italian doctors in the 1960s. Pull out one of her teeth and transplant it into one of her eyes to help repair the damaged cornea. With no other option, Kay signed on. Dr. Perez assembled a team, and for the next 2 years, they learned the procedure. They flew to Italy and flew Italian experts to Miami. They practiced with cadaver teeth and made trial versions of what they would do with Kay's tooth. Perez hoped it would be the greatest accomplishment of his life, and that he might be able to help the estimated 200 other patients like Kay who have severely damaged corneas. But if he botched it, the procedure would never catch on in the U.S.
You know, so many steps that things can go wrong. And yeah, I had to live with the concept that if it didn't work, people would quit on it and might not even refer patients to me anymore.
For all its complications, the procedure is actually pretty simple. A hole is cut in the damaged cornea, and a short acrylic tube is custom made to allow light in, kind of like cutting a hole in the wall and sticking a telescope through. But without something to hold the tube in place, the system fails. That's where the tooth comes in. Tooth, bone, and ligament have a better chance of living around the eye than a lot of other materials. So Perez removed Kay's canine tooth, also called, no kidding, the eye tooth. They sliced the root into a tiny plank and stuck the tube through the plank, then rested the plank-tube combination over the hole in her cornea. It has been 3 years since Kay met Dr. Perez.
And it was a humbling experience, Labor Day weekend, when we removed her bandage, that she could see Rick, she could see the TV, and she could see the blue sky.
Kay takes off her glasses. A tube like the end of a coffee stirrer pokes out through a tender-looking skin graft covering the rest of the eyeball and holding the tooth in place. The tiny tube darts around the room.
I can see some of your figures. The lights are so bright. If the lights were dimmer, I could see, you know, better.
She turns to Dr. Perez.
I could see you up there at the podium.
I'm glad.
Dr. Perez says the vision in Kay's eye is about 20/70 right now. With a magnifying glass, she can read a newspaper. But over time, and with glasses, her vision will be almost normal again. He estimates that there are about 200 patients like Kay, but says the treatment might also help Iraq war veterans with corneal scarring from explosion burns. For NPR News, I'm Kenny Malone in Miami.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.